All right, members, our technical problems seem to have subsided, so we will resume the agenda. So again, the first item on the agenda is House File 1778. The chair will move House File 1778 for possible inclusion in a later bill of our bonding priorities. And we'll begin the presenter Cornish by having House Research do a brief overview of the legislative history of this technical item, and then we'll move to you for your presentation. Is that okay, Representative Cornish?
Sounds good, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chair, committee members, one first thing before we get to Representative Cornish's bill. In your packet are two sheets stapled together. Fiscal Analysis Department at the top. This is the tracking sheet that Mr. Crow has put together for our Mr. Chair, thank you. This is the tracking sheet that Mr. Crow has put together for our committee to use for capital investment projects. There's two sheets. The first sheet on the back of it has a list of all the bills that have been introduced in the capital, seeking state capital money this year. Those are listed in the order on this sheet with the funding source by them, the amount of the request. And then the last two columns show the governor's recommendation amounts and then the governor less the total amount of the request. Finally, the last sheet on this is a list from the governor's capital budget. The process that capital projects go through, there's a process where they can go through the executive branch and they get recommended or not as part of the governor's budget. So that's all included in this two-page handout that you have from Mr. Crow. That will be updated as this committee makes its decisions on bonding matters. If there are no questions on that, Mr. Chair, we'll move on to the to House File 1778.
Any questions for members of the committee? Seeing none, Representative Cornish, welcome to the committee, and we'll get this microphone thing straightened out here in a second, so please proceed with your presentation and your testifiers.
Mr. Chair and members, I have with me today Christy Wetzel, a former member of the board of the USC, United South Central, and Superintendent Dr. Jerry Jensen with me. I'll give a short introduction and then turn it over to Ms. Wetzel. This is Christy, Mrs. Wetzel, and my probably at least third, maybe fourth appearance before this committee. We have tried to get funding before the Education Finance Committee and then before the Bonding Committee. And the bar has been set pretty high for us, and we are realists. And we realize that some of you might have doubts about funding the building of a school. However, the Cooperative Facilities Grant that you see here was set up, I think, especially for that. And this is a special case where we set up a system that we set the bar so high it's hard for schools like USC to attain that. And what I mean by that is we're in a ag-rich environment down there, and the referendums in the past have done real well in the city, but when it gets to the ag land, it increases the tax so much that they've been reluctant to sign off on it and therefore carry the vote. And so what we're coming to you today pleading for is, and I say that because this is about third or fourth time, is money, and we're asking for $20 million to be put into this cooperative facilities grant, the Department of Education, to be doled out, hopefully to USC, and any amount thereof that you decide on actually would really help, because it is our hope to buy down the building cost of this enough to encourage the farmers to sign on, even though it will still cost them some on their taxes. The more money that we input we could get from the state would really help. Now, I don't think we'll have to set a large precedent here because there's specific criteria that you have to get into this cooperative facilities grant, and there's only so much money, and I think there might be only one or two schools applying for this at the present time. So with that, I'll let turn it over to Ms. Christy Wetzel here for a presentation of the facts. If it's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Christy Wetzel.
Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing me this opportunity to speak to you on behalf of House File 1778. As many of you are familiar from the numbers of times we've been up here, Representative Cornish, Senator Rosen, myself and many members of our school community spent years working on the language change of the current Cooperative Facilities Grant. Please allow me to share some information about our school district and our building. The United South Central Public Schools are located in the south central part of Minnesota. We serve students from the communities of Briceland, Keister, Walters, Freeborn, Easton, and Wells. We consolidated over 20 years ago and have experienced the scars of consolidation. Three communities experienced the closing of their schools due to declining enrollment and budget cuts. Our remaining building is located in the largest of all the communities, and that is the city of Wells. Our building is one of the oldest in the state. Our high school building was built in 1932. We presented some handouts. I don't know if you have them in front of you or not, but the handout includes more extensive details of our building deficiencies, but I would like to highlight just a few. Some of the educational deficiencies we are subjected to are most classrooms are 23 to 33% smaller than state guidelines, which makes for very, very cramped classrooms. 20 traditional classrooms are now used as special education rooms, federally and state mandated support student support programs, and preschool classrooms. Our classrooms do not have the space for computers, and they lack the infrastructure to support the networks and the electrical needs of today's technology. We have minimal building security to prevent intruders from accessing student classrooms. Some of our structural deficiencies, which are numerous, include a heating system which is inefficient and dates back to 1932. Our main water supply is fed through pipes dating back to 1932, and in many cases are nearly plugged with mineral deposits and they leak throughout the building. Needless to say, the water is foul tasting. Our main electrical service panels use fuses, and they date back to the 1930s. All of our windows are single-paned, drafty, and in many cases, you can see a layer of ice on the inside of the building. There is no safe drop-off or pickup locations for our children because our school is located on a major highway. We've had three failed new building bond referendums. The first was in April of 2002. It was a $32 million building. 25% of our voters voted yes, 75% voted no. At that time, nearly $15 million of this referendum would have been paid through debt service equalization. In May of 2005, we went back to the voters with a $24.675 million building. 40% voted yes, 60% no, voted no. And at that time, only $200,000 would have been received through debt service equalization. In December 2005, we went back with the same exact proposal. 42% voted yes, 52% voted no. What are we proposing? We're proposing a new pre-K through 12 building on one site. It would cost approximately $28.8 million and was our best option of the nearly 15 options we thoroughly explored. The building is designed to meet the ever-changing dynamics of a 21st century education. The new building is designed to be cost-effective and efficient. United South Central is a unique and unfavorable situation with regard to passing a bond referendum to support a new support building a new school. Here's what makes USC so unique. We have 50% of our students qualifying for free or reduced price lunches. And I realize this is not uncommon around the state. However, we truly live in an impoverished area. Looking only at the largest town in our six communities, the average family income is $38,000 in Wells. The state average is $55,600. In stark contrast, the average home in Wells is valued at $75,000, and the state average is $200,400. We all know property taxes are what pay for schools. When home values are significantly lower than the state average, so are the property taxes based on their values. If this was USC's only concern, we would still qualify for debt service formula and possibly see state aid dollars to assist in the cost of a new building. But as our housing values have decreased, our agricultural land values have skyrocketed. This is where the dilemma is created. Our ag land values have caused USC to fall off the debt formula, or the formula for debt service equalization, and is not indicative of our communities as a whole. Ag land is owned by a relatively small number of people, and very few of the owners purchase land at inflated current values. Many of the owners are farming their land as their livelihood and renting additional land from landowners who have retired from farming. When we held our last vote in 2005 on a new building, We knew agricultural landowners would be paying nearly 72% of the cost of a new building in the form of higher taxes. Some land taxes would have increased as much as $6.40 an acre for just the school portion of their taxes. Fast forward 7 years, and the situation is even more unsettling. Agricultural land prices have increased again, home values have fallen, and it may be safe to say that our ag land owners will pay 80% of the cost of a $28 million new school. Ag land taxes could go as high as $16.49 an acre. That's an additional $1,319.20 on an 80-acre parcel in taxes. 80 acres is not a lot of farmland. We live in an area that exists because of farming, and we have very limited industries. In fact, our school district is the second largest employer in all of our six communities. Minnesota's Constitution in Article 13, Section 1, calls for a uniform system of public schools. It continues on by stating, the legislature shall make provisions by taxation or otherwise, as will secure a thorough and efficient system of public schools throughout the state. This is truly a bipartisan issue. It's about kids. The $20 million outlined in House File 1778 would allow us the opportunity to build a school and level the playing field in regard to the small number of ag land owners and the taxes they would pay. It's an opportunity to provide our students with a building that is uniform in regard to schools throughout the state. In fact, to many, it would appear modest. I have enclosed in your handout the blueprint of the proposed new school, the tax impact information, remodel options we explored, and the costs associated with it, and pictures of our current facility. I encourage you to look through the information we've provided. I am confident that approval of House File 1778 and the funding of it would tip the scales and allow USC to finally build the school building our students deserve. I implore you to examine the situation and support House File 1778, helping USC to build a safe school, empowering our children with the tools necessary to provide them for prepare them for success for generations to come. With the generous help of representatives like yourselves, USC will be able to provide a building to meet the needs of children receiving a 21st century education. Thank you so much for your time and attention, and I do welcome your questions.
Thank you very much. And again, members who have been in this committee before are familiar with the issue of adjusted net tax capacity, and as a testifier laid out, how within one jurisdiction the increase in ag land is factored into that measurement of property wealth that is used for debt service equalization. If members of the committee wish, we can have Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow talk about that a little bit more. Otherwise, I hopefully members are familiar with the equalizing factors and how those differ from facilities compared to operating levies. Representative Cornish, did you have any additional testifiers?
Dr. Jerry, he didn't want to testify, but just here, I asked a question. Answer questions.
This is their question, Mr. Chair.
Super. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I sympathize with your situation, but just wondering what your student population figures look like now and into the future.
Mr. Chair, Representative, right now we're sitting at 600 pupils, K-12. We're experiencing some enrollment decline that's running through the district. However, we are somewhat unique in that throughout the consolidation process, we ended up having about 200 of our students enroll elsewhere. And that's a kind of a hard piece to get your hands around when you're trying to figure out if we build a new building, how many of those students will we be drawing back in. So our assumption is that our enrollment's going to stabilize. And if we had a different facility, we may be able to grow.
Representative Cornish.
Yes, and if I might add that another school within my legislative district, Lake Crystal Welcome Memorial, had been in a similar situation, tried time after time to pass a referendum. Finally, they did. They built a new school, and now they're having numbers of new students and the students coming back. It really improved the atmosphere there. So I think the same thing would happen in USC.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, sympathize with your situation. And But it's one of the unfortunate things is when we have depended on the local property taxpayers to pay for building. And I just want to point out, because the session is just beginning and the school trust lands discussion is just beginning, I wanted to first of all ask Representative Cornish if he has any school trust lands in his district.
Representative Cornish, I don't think you do. Representative Cornish. So. Representative Dietrich.
So that's unfortunate. They've all probably been sold. There are some states that actually use the revenue generated from school trust lands to build buildings because they felt like that was the original intent of the Constitution. And there are some people that believe that we would not have, if we would have actually managed and used that money to actually build our schools and do what it was originally intended to, that we would have not had to revert to the property tax system for funding for the inequity in funding buildings throughout the throughout the state. So I just had to get that little editorial in.
And stay tuned to future committee hearings on that issue. And members, just to be clear, there's multiple unique situations in this district, and one of them is that as their student count is going down, and as just the farmland values are going up, by the measures we use for equalization, this district is getting wealthier. And as we've heard from testimony, that is not the case. And so if there was a statewide policy change we made to equalization, it actually would benefit a lot of districts, but not yours, because the factors we use for those many reasons, but those are the two main reasons, are with the rising values of farmlands as well as the reduced enrollment. So just to be clear, this is kind of separate from the equalization issue and how much money the state provides to provide additional services for children versus how much do we do to provide property tax relief to communities. So this is a unique, again, this has been around, this is hardly the first committee to hear this issue, but it's a very unique situation where your district seems to fall through the cracks of the individual programs that are meant to assist it. Other questions from members of the committee? Representative Downing.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm new to the committee and never was on a school board, and I'm curious, what are the kind of statutory provisions under which a school district can actually come to the state and request bonding, state GO bonding support?
Sure. Well, I think if it's okay with Representative Cornish, we'll go to Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom to talk about the secondary facilities grant program. So Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow?
Mr. Chair, committee members, we've got a couple of programs in statute that are set up to have state GO bonding used for school districts. This bill is under the one called the Cooperative Facilities Program. And this program was created back in the 1980s. The goal of the program was to help districts that were consolidating to essentially give them a carrot for building a new facility. It was originally designed as a secondary program. There were five groups of districts that got grants under the program. Those grant amounts back in the 80s and early 90s ranged from $6 to $8 million for the secondary facilities. A few of those were out Representative Anderson's way with the Minnewaska school that was built for Glenwood, Starbuck, and Villard, and then also the Grant County districts got together with that. Down by the United South Central School District, the Blue Earth School District received a cooperative secondary facilities grant. And that program then essentially went unused for most of the late 90s and early part of 2000s, and then in I think about 2005 or 6, the program was expanded to include all cooperative facilities, not just secondary facilities. And the definition of cooperation under the old design of the program, the districts had to consolidate after that time. Under the changes that were made in 2005 or 6, the program was broadened to include those districts such as USC that had already consolidated. There's been a series of requests in the past several years. There was a group in the Lincoln County area that came in with a request a few years ago, and then another group that you'll hear from today, the Rushford-Peterson District. But those have been the main, I think, three groups of school districts that have expressed an interest in this program. There's a second bonding program that the state has that anticipates the state using general obligation bonds called the Maximum Effort Capital Loan Program, and we'll talk about that a little bit with the Red Lake request later today. That program was established in 1959. and was designed as a program where schools that had low tax base, and at that time it was primarily the very, metropolitan districts with very fast growth, the fringe of the metropolitan area that were the primary districts that qualified. And the idea behind that is the state would use general obligation bonds to make a loan to the school districts. And then the school districts would pay that loan back over time as their tax base increased. Many of the districts that have gotten maximum effort loans in the last 20 or 25 years have been relatively property poor and have not had the ability to pay those loans back, and most of those loans were forgiven after 30 years. So if there was any outstanding balance and any outstanding interest on them, that was not forgiven. That was forgiven at that time, and so the period of the loan, after the period of the loan, it essentially became a grant to the districts. So those are the two programs, and I'd be happy to answer specific questions about either, but those are the two programs that are set up in the K-12 code that anticipate a school district. There's a third one. There's a smaller program that hasn't been used in several years for certain disabled access and accessibility improvements, and there were some grants made under that program in the mid-1990s. A legislator named Roger Cooper was primarily responsible for the grants under that program, but that hasn't been used in recent years. So those three are the ones where the state has in-statute programs for districts to get general obligation bonds. There's also been a couple of instances where the state has used bonding authority and simply made a grant outside of these programs to a group of districts with general obligation bonds. Actually, I should name one more, and there was also a desegregation grant program in the early 80s or mid-80s that used capital GO bonds from the state. But I think those are the four that are in statute.
And I also think they built a pool in Edina, too. So Representative Downey. Not really, Representative Downey, not really.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. One follow-on question, if I could, Mr. Chair. So just to be clear, so district level consolidation is kind of the trigger then, or the key event, and I assume then that this does not apply or is not available to charter schools?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, that's correct. It's not available to charter schools, and under the current configuration of the Cooperative Facilities Program, the districts have to have had consolidation since 1980 or be consolidating into the future.
Representative, any other questions for members of the committee? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion to Representative Anderson again.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair, for acknowledging me. Just a clarification, what kind of funding is available in the Cooperative Facilities Program? Is there a limit? Is it bonding dollars? And how much could we allocate to schools?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, under the current configuration of the program, each time a project comes through, the amount needs to be appropriated. There's no money there in the account, so that would have to come from the bond fund. When the program was established, the idea initially was that maybe the state would set aside $20 or $30 million of general obligation bonds and then districts would apply. But the way it's really turned out is that districts bring a proposal to the legislature, and if that's approved, then the bond authority is approved at the time. In the statute itself, the state contribution is limited to a maximum of $20 million, or not more than 75% of the cost of the project.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Any closing comments, Representative Cornish?
No, just thank you for your time and attention. I appreciate seeing us again.
And Representative Cornish, I never thought I'd say this, but you're the only guy I know that can make a tie, a leather jacket, and handcuffs look good.
So, thank you very much.
With that, the chair will renew his motion to have House File 1778 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you very much for your visit and your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Davids. The chair will move House File 1997 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Davids, do you have a testifier or testifiers with you?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman.
Please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee for hearing House File 1997, which is the Rushford-Peterson School District. It's a request for an appropriation of $20 million. From the Cooperative Facilities Grant. Just a brief history, then I want to have most of the time spent with the superintendent and other folks from the City of Rushford, or the Rushford-Peterson School District that are here to testify. In 2007, some of you were here in the legislature. I had a 45-vote two-year vacation where I was not here during that time. But Representative Pawlowski really picked up the ball on this and carried legislation to help the city of Rushford. They had a terrible, terrible flood in August of 2007. We received about 19, 20 inches of rain, and floods can ensue from that. And the city was devastated. Basically, the only building on the main street that wasn't damaged by floodwaters was the Catholic Church. So there was extensive damage to the school. And ever since then, the school board and superintendent and local officials have worked very hard to try to put this together to consolidate basically two buildings into one and have a new facility for the Rushford-Peterson School District. So with that, I would like to turn it over for a presentation from Superintendent Chuck Ehler, I'll turn it over to him.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Chuck Ehler. I'm the superintendent at Rushford-Peterson Schools. Chairman Grafflaw, we would like to start, and members of the committee, we would like to start this presentation by a short video, so if you would please pay attention to the monitors. Thank you.
You know, all the businesses were shut down, so some of them were able to get going again. Some were not.
And it's still a long ways to go as far as financial recovery for our community.
We have to have jobs, and only some jobs were replaced. So whenever it starts to rain, or it rains heavily, even still, now you can see the kids' anxiety levels going up.
This is the story of the irreparable damage sustained by Rushford-Peterson's public school system from a natural disaster. Part of the building has wood pilings, and all of the building is built on a foundation of sand. The great flood unsettled the foundations of the building. It is evident in every corner of the complex.
Whenever a foundation is compromised on a building such as it is with ours right now, we see lots of different things going on. Walls shifting, floors settling, ceilings settling. The building is shifting and therefore causing these materials to crack and break away from the original surface.
Luckily, no one was here, but you can imagine what would have happened if this had hit someone.
The secretary beyond me in the other office came running, thinking I'd dropped something or fallen, but actually a large piece of plaster had fallen onto the ceiling, and plaster dust covered my desk.
Mostly I hear it. I hear it falling from the floor above and landing on the panels in the ceiling.
Well, and I go back to my storage rooms that I have, and there's a wall that, if you touch the bricks, it just crumbles right in front of your eyes. You can keep on touching, and it'll keep on crumbling.
And the raw sewage level left a mark here on our doors.
There's continuing problems with mold and odors. I know staff people are affected by the mold.
The school's heating and air circulation system was horribly inadequate before the flood. And even though the building was exhaustively cleaned, the thought of children breathing air from the porous recesses of that basement without adequate ventilation is an ongoing concern. You would think the citizens of Rushford-Peterson School District would have fixed these problems by now, but they've got a lot on their hands. The city of Rushford is still recovering from 17 inches of rain. Stricken that day were banks, clinics, drug stores, dental offices, restaurants, the post office, police and fire stations, city wells, and the wastewater treatment center. In addition, roughly 490 of 766 homes and businesses were damaged or destroyed when two-thirds of the city was covered by floodwater.
As a result of the flood, our free and reduced numbers increased from 37% to 58%, and our current levels still maintain around 47%. We lost 13 students and families that moved away and directly impacted us financially to the tune of about $160,000 per year.
This is not a property-rich community, so there's no easy way to distribute the cost of a new facility. The citizens of Rushford-Peterson School District can't handle a 48% increase in their local debt service. Taxes on a $100,000 house would increase by $346 and as much as $748 on a house valued at $175,000.
There are a lot of people who had money left to pay on that house. Now you add a minimum of $50,000 more onto that mortgage, and that's a burden.
Rushford-Peterson isn't asking the state to cover the entire cost of the building. What they need is help with costs associated with replacing the structure that was devastated by a natural disaster. The board is preparing to ask the residents of the district to cover a third of the cost of replacing the building complex. We recognize that we must be willing to do this before we would ask the state to commit.
We are number two on the Minnesota Department of Education's bonding priority list, and we're happy that the legislators and governor recognize the need for us to have use of the Cooperative Facilities Grant. Our goal with our new school initiative is to provide economic stability to our region, as well as to provide a bright future for our families, our children, and our staff members here, as well as all the communities involved in the Rushford-Peterson School District.
Representative Davids, the information we have is the governor did not include this in his bonding recommendations.
That's correct. The Department of Education, I think it was number two on their list, but it was not included by the governor.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed with your testimony, or testify, Jim.
Chair Grapplo, if I may, and committee members, if I may, I'd like to introduce who else is here today assisting with our presentation. I have Angela Colvinson, our board chairperson. I have Brad Hoynes, who is a business person and parent from Rushford as well. I have Gary Benson from ICS Consulting, who we've been working with since day one and was instrumental in helping us put things together. Gary Olson of Ehlers and Associates, our financial, and from ATS&R, Dean Beninga. So all of these individuals are here, and they've been instrumental in helping us move our project forward. Again, I want to take this opportunity to thank you for hearing our story today. As the video clearly pointed out to you, we have a compelling need at our school district. And we are located in the beautiful southeast corner of the state. We're halfway between Rochester and La Crosse, just off 10 miles south of I-90. I'm in my fifth year as superintendent of the school district. I arrived in the school district 5 weeks prior to the flood of August 2007. And as many of you may have heard, that was a 500-year flood, supposedly. But I had the opportunity to endure firsthand the impact of that natural disaster. And we're still dealing with the impact from that disaster. At the time, no one really realized what was... We could see everything on the surface, but we really didn't know what was taking place underneath. And now, as our building, as we clearly pointed out in the video, begins to move and shift, we're beginning to understand that there were some things that were taking place underground as well as above ground. Our school suffered nearly $1 million in damage, in property damage as well as building damages. And today, as I pointed out, we're experiencing some foundation and structural issues as well. Some of the other things that we're dealing with in our building, and I brought examples today. They showed them to you in the video, but this is an exact example of what we're dealing with. This is the plaster in their ceiling, and this is from 1906 construction, and it is, as you can see, you can't see from where you're sitting, but the fibers that stick out from this is actually horsehair, because back in 1906 when they constructed this building, that's what they used to hold the product together. In addition to that, we're also seeing our plumbing, and I brought an example of that. This is what's taking place inside of our building as well.
And I also mentioned to you about some other issues, but we have a situation where in one of our bathrooms, the urinal, the drain completely rusted off, and the toilet was being, or the urinal was being flushed directly into the ground underneath the school building. So that gives you an example of some of the things that we're dealing with, the video mentioned, as well as heating and air quality issues as well. With the assistance and guidance of Gary Benson of ICS Consulting, we've taken the necessary steps to secure funds for a new school. And thanks to their direction, we worked with a community task force made up of 30-plus members, and thanks to their input, their recommendation back to us was to pursue a new early childhood through 12 building. We currently have two facilities. We have one located in Peterson that houses our middle school, grades 6 through 8, and then our main center that is located there in Rushford. The Rushford building contains early childhood through 5th grade as well as grades 9 through 12. So the recommendation from that committee was to proceed and looking at all avenues to proceed with seeking the funds and the necessary steps to secure a new facility for our community. As was pointed out to you already, the Cooperative Facilities Grant is in place. It's a part of the Minnesota statutes, 123A.442, and it does allow the legislature to include this in the bonding proposals, can fund up to $20 million, but not to exceed 75% of the entire project. Our projected costs are in the neighborhood of $29 million. And if that were to be approved, we would have to go out and seek a $9 million approval from the local referendum. What does this mean for our school district? If we were to try and fund the entire project, the impact for our community would be a 48% tax increase. Even if we were to be fortunate enough to get the $20 million and still have to go out and seek a $9 million referendum, we would be facing a 17% increase. We simply do not have the tax base or the capacity to support full funding of this special project for our school districts. I have Gary Olson from Ehlers and Associates here today to verify any data, any questions that you may have in regards to the information that is provided to you today on our informational sheets. And Gary has been working with us as well as with Gary Benson of ICS, and we have looked at all different avenues and all different programs, and there are simply no other options that we can see that are viable for us to move forward with our project. I'm hopeful today that you can see that we have a critical situation. We are compelled to make every effort to provide a safe learning environment for our students. I implore you to carefully analyze our critical needs for a new facility and to include our request as part of the bonding proposals for 2012. The safety and the future of our school district are depending on you. I also encourage you to embrace our school motto, which is always our best. We are counting on you to do your best and to assist us in providing our school and our new school initiative with the financial support it desperately needs. I thank you for your attention today and would ask that you support House File 1997. Thank you. And at this time, I'd like to introduce Brad Hoynes, who is a businessman from the community of Rushford and as well as has children in our school district.
Thank you, Chairman Garofalo and members of the committee. Again, my name is Brad Hoynes. I'm married with four children, ages 11, 8, 5, and 3. I was born and raised in Rushford, graduated from Rushford High School, and attended have a business degree from the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. 15 years ago, I joined my father in the grocery business in Rushford, and we also have stores in Preston and Harmony, Minnesota, employing 122 people. We own and pay property taxes on 5 commercial buildings, 3 of which are in Rushford, in addition to our homes. The flood of 2007 also devastated our business and the entire business community, of course, as you saw, causing extensive damage. Our entire inventory was destroyed. There was 4 feet of water in our building, and most of our equipment, and caused extensive building damage. What followed the flood, though, was truly inspirational to watch and be part of. We wouldn't want to go through it again, but first and foremost was the core group of business owners who would not let us give up, followed by the hundreds of volunteer hours generous donations, support from our vendor partners, and in just 74 days, we were able to reopen our grocery store in Rushford on October 31st, 2007. Following the flood, the downtown businesses were being rebuilt at various stages, and based on their timelines and the resources they had, but clearly it was you, the legislators, that gave us the opportunity to rebuild our Rushford economy, and I thank you for that. It was you, the legislators, providing the financial help of the Minnesota Investment Flood Loan Recovery Program. This legislation was the catalyst to provide the funds for Rushford businesses to rebuild and to reopen, and also provide the best chance for a return to viability and a productive economy. For example, the property taxes on a Rushford buildings rose by 9.8% to $25,570 in 2012. This amount combined with the previous 5 year totals more than $121,000. In 2011, $56,000 in sales taxes was collected and sent to the state of Minnesota from our Rushford business, with a 5 year total from our Rushford operations of approximately $250,000. This doesn't also include the sales tax we paid on equipment purchases. So I guess what my point is, I'm trying to prove that we are returning to a productive economy. However, we're not out of the woods yet. The health of our business community remains fragile, as many of our customers are still recovering from rebuilding their homes and the costs associated with that. Our homeowners are also dealing with additional assessments that they have for repairs to the sewer and water systems, which also involves rebuilding the streets stemming from the flood. In my opinion, to ask the residents of the district to fund the entire $29 million is just not feasible. But I ask you for your support to give our school district leadership here the opportunity to at least take this proposal of $9 million building referendum to our voters in the district. And if approved, I understand that our small businesses will face increased property taxes for years to come. But I also have faith, as with many of my other local core group of business owners, and believe that we owe our children this, and the positive benefits will outweigh the costs. And in any community, the strength of our school system is closely tied to the vitality of our community. And again, I thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Chair Graffalo and members of the committee, I know we're on our time frame. Please bear with us. We have a 3 minute presentation here from our board chairperson, Angela Colvinson.
The committee, please.
Thank you, Chair Garofalo and other members of the committee. My name is Angela Colvinson. I have a son in third grade and a two-year-old daughter that attends early childhood family education programs in a room that had the layer of sewage that you saw in the video. I'm also the chairperson of the board of Rushford Peterson School, so I have the entire board's support of a new school. The problem we're facing is money. Because we're one of the few schools without a general obligation bond, the funding ratio from the state is very small for state support. This leaves us at a disadvantage for support because we do not have current debt. As a result of the flood, many individuals and businesses took on additional loans to rebuild their flood-ravaged buildings. Consequently, people do not have the money to fund a new school. Approximately half of our children qualify for free and reduced lunch. Because of the devastating flood of 2007, our school is in peril. My fear is that we may become the next I-35 bridge. But truth be told, we've had several issues with our 1906 building before the flood. As I was listening to USC, the lady speak from USC, I kept saying to myself, me too, a lot of the same items that she listed we are experiencing as well. Ceilings are falling. Foundation bricks are crumbling, sewage is leaking straight into the ground, floors are sinking, and indoor air quality is irreparable. The greatest fear is that our school building will harm children. For example, my son was in a preschool classroom that had mold. We didn't know that was a cause of his breathing problems, and as a result, we had to administer drugs so that he could breathe better. His problem cleared up when he left the classroom a year later. We've had other children depart our school district because of illnesses and indoor air quality issues. As a board, we've looked at numerous solutions. We've inquired of area school districts about another consolidation. We've already consolidated once, so we've looked at a second consolidation. However, the area schools had neither capacity for our students nor the interest. We've examined performing a major overhaul of our present building, but you have to have a positive review and comment from the Department of Education, and they were unable to give us the positive review because of our aging facilities. We've asked the public to fund a new school, The taxpayers are willing, but because of the flood, financially unable to pay for the entire portion of the school. Why should you fund our school? Personally, to prevent another I-35 catastrophe that could gain attention of national media. To keep business in Rushford, we are a strong community with a resilience that was shown through many people through the flood. Area communities have lost big corporate factories, and Rushford's doing our best to fill empty buildings. We have a good community. We have an excellent school with great teachers. Our kids are polite, respectful, have good sportsmanship, and because of the flood, they have had more challenges than most adults have experienced in their lifetime. We meet all the criteria of the Cooperative Facilities Grant, and it is a basic necessity to fund education for all kids. It is one of the most important investments you can contribute to. Chairperson Garofalo and other representatives, thank you very much for your time, and thank you in advance for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Members, any quick questions from the committee? Representative Davis, any closing comments?
I would just like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for your consideration. We would really appreciate your support on House File 1997.
Thank you. And with that, the chair will renew his motion to have House File 1997 laid over for possible inclusion in our bonding priorities. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Representative Fritz. Happy anniversary, Representative Fritz. The chair will move House File 1794 for possible inclusion in our bonding priorities. And Representative Fritz, you have an A2 amendment. That's yours, correct?
Yes.
So the chair will move the A2 amendment to put the bill in the form that the author would like. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Fritz, do your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me, and members. Thank you for all of the support that you've given to us, the State Academies for the Deaf and the Blind that are located in Faribault, Minnesota in the past. And again, we are here at this time with our proposal that the amendment that you just added along with the other four proposals that we have that we are asking for in this bonding session. And we are in the governor's recommendation, and very grateful for that as well. And today, to explain these briefly, I have the administrator of the Minnesota State Academies in Faribault, Linda Mitchell, and I'm going to hand it over to her. She has a brief some comments on all four of our proposals and the school itself. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative, and welcome, Ms. Mitchell, and please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Linda Mitchell. I am the superintendent of the State Academies. We are located down in Faribault, Minnesota, and I have with me today as a backup, in case there are any technical questions here on facilities, our physical plant director, Randy Dirks. We have handouts we would like to give to you, which will be coming around, and I can explain a little bit about the request that we are making for the bonding bill. While those are being handed out, if I may, I would just like to take a minute to thank you. We were here last time asking for trial placement language for students to attend the academies, and the passage of that legislation this last time has been in 6 months, a huge impact on our student enrollment. We have between 10 and 15 students now who are attending under that trial placement language. It has been a good thing for students, for families, and for schools. So we very much appreciate your support and have seen good things come from that. So thank you very much. To talk a little bit about our campuses, the Minnesota State Academy for the Blind and the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf are about between a half a mile and a mile apart, located in Faribault. We are two special schools. On the Blind School campus, we have really four buildings. The Library for the Blind is on our campus. It is a part of the Department of Education and is not part of our school, although our students use it. We also have an industrial building, the Lyson Complex, and the A-plus house, which was just constructed, and this first year we have seven young ladies who are now living in that building. On the deaf school campus, we have 10 major buildings. Two of those are on the historic registry. And if I may, I will take a second and explain what's in your packets. On the left side, you have the documentation with the governor's recommendations and our narrative for our agency. On the right side, there are some pictures, and if we can start with the first one, the campus map of the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf. The two buildings that are historic buildings are Tate Hall and Noyes Hall. We are requesting funding for a technology center, which is the red outline diagram at the very bottom of the page. This technology center would replace Mott Hall, which is on the far left side of the campus. I can recall back in 1997-98 when we had capital investment bonding groups going through and touring our campuses, and at that time that was our, and still is, our old vocational building, and we were asked the question, how did it ever get in such horrible shape? Well, very honestly, for years it was funding that we did not have to improve it, and it is now a building that is no longer functional for student technology. The technology center we were given pre-design money for last year. We have worked very hard to make this building a building that will work for blind students and for deaf students, both. And so our intent here is to request the $6.15 million for this technology center. The second picture that you see, or the second page on the right side, is a diagram of what this technology center would include. I probably should back up a little bit and explain that one of the things that is a real plus for our populations is that technology has made a huge improvement in their skills and abilities and being able to maintain, get employment that is more than a long time ago when we had blind folks who tuned pianos and made brooms and what else is there to do. We are now in an age where, with the new technology, the challenges that our populations face can be broadly talked about in terms of access to information. How that happens in a classroom now for blind students, where we have screen readers and commuters with JAWS access, has leveled the playing field so that they really are able to access information at the same time as their sighted peers. The same is true for people who are deaf. This is a great time to be a deaf person when you can text anybody, because that was something that a long time ago there was a TTY that was as big as this desk, and that was the only way you could talk to somebody on the phone. Well, those days are past, and so now we have other challenges, which include those of having to take those Sidekicks and Blackberries so kids aren't texting each other in the middle of the night, but that's a different kind of problem. So our goal with having this kind of technology center available is to help our students become employable. And instead of having a 90% unemployment or even higher for our blind population, and I would say for the deaf population it may not be as high unemployment, but certainly underemployed, that this now makes a difference. We have students who are in internships. We now have a graduate who is employed at SAGE, which is one of our manufacturing centers in Faribault. So we see a real plus in our students being able to access these skills while they're still in the K-12 system. Again, as I said, we have designed this building so it is usable for both populations. If we move to the next page, you can see kind of an interior of the various spaces, and there is one large presentation area as well as a, and I hesitate to call it a fab lab because I think we were told that there may be some patent on that name, so I don't mean to get myself in trouble, but that is the intent, that it would be able to provide the students with those kinds of opportunities. The last picture that I have included for our technology center, and I bring this out because we're not being frivolous with money, and the reason that we have this big sort of, it's like a hotel, the drive under carport thing, is because we have a real issue which we have found out, especially on the blind school campus. So many of our kids are in wheelchairs or are moving slowly with physical disabilities, that we need a place to get them out of their vehicles and into the building without being out in the rain and the snow. That has been a huge problem on the MSAB campus. So it isn't just for looks. There's a real purpose that this is there. Having said that, we also have asset preservation money, and I believe in your packet from the governor's budget, I can direct you to page 6, and you can see the listing of asset preservation projects. We don't seem to run out of roofs and buildings and sidewalks and things that need repair, and we have a couple of large old stone buildings that need tuck pointing, and here's where I know enough about this to be dangerous, but I know that's something that needs to happen. And so unfortunately those are ongoing expenses. I guess if anybody has any questions about that, I would refer them to Mr. Dirks here. Our third request, and this is a little complicated, but Frechette Hall is the boys' dorm on the deaf school campus and is a building that really is one of the newer buildings on campus, but one of the most poorly constructed. Some of you have toured that more than once and seen that while it was a design of the times back in the late 60s, it is certainly not a design for deaf people. It is a very low ceiling. There are corridors and corners and steps and things to go down that just were not designed for people who sign. That's kind of that makes it difficult, but if the structure was solid, it wouldn't be an issue. Unfortunately, we've had the building leak. We have each one of the pods, there's an A, a B, and a C, and they are connected to the main building by walkways that have plexiglass in them, and honestly, where the doors are, the snow comes in, the water comes in, it freezes, it thaws. It's a very poor building in shape and needs to be demolished. We have a plan in place to, now that we have the bathrooms in Pollard Hall are being renovated and handicapped accessible, so we have a plan in place where we could move our boys in an interim until we have a new dorm built. So we would like to take Frechette down because we would like the new dorm to go in that place. There is also a building on the campus, and let me go back to your map here. I can help a little bit. On this one, there is a number 3 that Frechette is the one that would be demolished, that is the dorm. The other one is called the laundry building. That is one, the only building that is left from the original campus. And so this one goes back to the 1860s. Very honestly, right now there's nothing in it but junk. There were years ago we put a new roof on it. It needs to come down. I suppose if we tried to use it, I don't even know what we'd do. There's asbestos in it, and it is no longer a usable space. So those are the two projects that we are asking for demolition money, that they be removed. Number 4, there is a 4 north of the gym in this picture. That is the parking lot. And as we talk about our campus, you see there's an inner circle here called Olaf Hansen Drive. That inner circle is the main play area where there's a softball field. It's where the students spend a lot of their time when the weather is nice. That is also the place and the only place, really, that we have for parking. When our gym was built back in the 1930s, there obviously weren't so many automobiles that that was an issue. Right now, there is no place to park. And again, if this was just a parking issue, I wouldn't be bringing it up. But our issue is also tied to safety. And what happens is because the students, the buildings are all around the outside and the students are playing in the middle. And we have parallel parking that goes around that circle. But what happens is that, of course, kids don't pay any attention to that. So there is always the danger of our kids who run between those cars back and forth from the dorm to the play area, etc. And the problem is that they're deaf. So they don't hear car horns. They're not paying attention. This is where they live. Our goal is to try and get traffic out of this inner circle. And right now on Shumway Avenue, while it is not on this picture, we own the land that Chaddock uses to drive into their campus, and their road is already there. We would be coming off of Shumway over to where number 4 is for parking, so that when we have all these vehicles on campus for sporting events in the gym, they would not be coming in through that circle, and we would be able to keep them away from where the kids are. So that's number 4. Our last request is an A-plus house, and I do want to call your attention. I put a little folder in, or a little pamphlet thing in here. This is the A-plus house. This is what you gave us money for last time, and we now have students living in the A-plus house on the blind school campus. This was the unique collaboration with our local South Central College. This was the carpentry class that has been building houses in Faribault for the last 40, well, this one was 44. So what had happened was obviously they were building houses and selling them and taking the money to use for their next project. And with the economy the way it was, we had a need. This house serves our students who are 18 to 21, what I would call non-traditional students, who they may have finished their high school coursework. They are not yet ready and prepared to live independently. Some of that has to do with, well, on the blind school campus, it's orientation and mobility, learning to be able to navigate the world independently, learning to do your laundry, learning to cook, clean, take care of where you live. And so this house is where our what we call the A-plus students, students who this is their last stop. They may be taking technical college courses this year and living on our campus. They may be working in the community and living in this house. But the next step is after this year, they will be out and totally on their own. We are requesting a similar kind of thing on the deaf school campus, which would, in essence, do the same kind of thing and fulfill the same kind of purpose. Any questions?
Thank you, Representative Fritz. Does that complete your presentation?
Yes, it does, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to again reiterate and thank you all for all of the years and all of the help and opportunities that you've given to the students at the deaf and blind school in Faribault. And I really think we're fortunate to live in this day and age where we actually see progress and accomplishments that those students can have, that I have. And so the equality factors is really important. And then again, it's jobs. This and what Ms. Mitchell said is, if there was a good time to be deaf, I guess it would be in this at this time when everything is texting and dexterity and being able to participate in life fuller as they are. So again, thank you for those opportunities, for these living skills and these living areas that you've given to them. But of course, many are old and deteriorating, and we want to continue to provide for them. And again, thank you for all of the years of help, and we ask that we continue this.
Any questions from members of the committee? Representative Dabney, then Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Superintendent Mitchell. I appreciate the description you gave of the laundry building and its usefulness, but when you said it dated back to the 1860s, it does beg the question of, is there a historic preservation issue that could crop up there with the age of the building and the historic nature of the academies?
To testify?
I'll give you my opinion, and then I will also I'll let our physical plant director respond. And I do have to say that that is one of the things that it's not that this has not been discussed. I'm going to say 20 years ago, because I was at the academies as a teacher before I got into administration. The deaf community wanted to make it a deaf cultural center. If you look at its location, quite frankly, when you come into campus and Randy's physical plant really hides it, you can't see it. It's not a large building. There was a time when they did not want it to come down. I think I've been back to the, you know, folks two or three times and said, okay, are you sure now? Are you sure? And as much as we would like to do that, somebody would have had to do a lot more 50 to 100 years ago to make it possible. So, yes.
I think that pretty much answers it. And again, we invite all of you to come anytime to tour and to see these buildings. And there are two historical buildings on the campus now that are designated. So I think that should suffice, I would hope.
Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Mitchell, what happens to Mott Hall once you do your project?
I'm smiling because he's right here. The power plant actually is right next to Mott Hall. Mm-hmm. And what this is going to provide, because admittedly the structure is solid, it's not going to fall down, it is not usable for education. However, we would like to be able to move his carpenter out of power plant and move it next door, so that space is going to be utilized by the maintenance folks.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Mr. McHenry, I had a quick question on the recommendation. Can I come down for a sec? I'll just ask it as you're coming down. The agency lists asset preservation as the number one priority, but they only fund it at one-third of its level, but the second priority is funded at 100%. Can you perhaps give some context to us on why that is? I don't think it's fair to ask Representative Fritz or that.
Mr. Chair, members, on the overall agency funding proposals for the bonding request, separate from this one, the process was. That the proposals would go through the department for a review, and then we would submit those to the governor's office for the governor's office to put together the bonding bill. Through the three that came through our agency that were listed, it was the Red Lake facility. It was the number two was the Rushford Peterson facility, and number three was the library. Bonding proposal, and those were not included in the governor's bonding proposal.
Okay. I got my personnel mixed up. Is there anyone from the governor's office here to comment on that? Sorry, I know you're with MDE. No? Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. McHenry, before you leave today, would you speak with the gentleman at the door, Mr. Heller, about an issue he has with print disability, and he'd like it included in the governor's language? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McHenry.
Thank you.
So any other questions from members of the committee? Seeing none with that, the chair will renew his motion to have House File 1794 as amended laid over for possible inclusion in the bonding priorities. Thank you, Representative Fritz.
Good
to see
you. Thank you.
Representative McFarland. Just a reminder to members of the committee, if your cell phone is extremely active, you may want to shut it off so that this do not disrupt the committee hearings. Okay, Representative McFarland, are we starting with 1851 first?
Yes, and we have an amendment.
All right, the chair will move House File 1851 for possible inclusion in our bonding priorities, and Representative McFarland has an amendment to that bill. And this is putting the amendment puts the bill in the shape that you would like, the A1 amendment. Is that correct, Representative McFarland?
Correct. It puts the dollar amount in.
All right. The chair moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. 1851 is in the form the author would like. Representative McFarland, to your bill. And if you could, please try to be brief in both presentations. We still have Representative Winkler, and if we get lucky, Representative Hancock.
And welcome to the committee. And I have two bills today, too. So.
Yes.
Okay. We'll be brief, but impactful. Mr. Chair, this appropriates $2 million for library accessibility and improvement grants statewide. I have two testifiers to speak on behalf. I have Elaine Keith from the Minnesota Library Association and Nathan Matthews from the City of Staples, and I'll let them speak.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Elaine Keith. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Library Association. And this grant program was originally established in 1994 to provide matching grants to public libraries to make their buildings handicap accessible. And after a few years, the libraries that only needed modest renovations to make them accessible had largely been dealt with. And what we found we were left with was buildings that really needed major renovations or outright replacement. And communities were understandably reluctant to spend the money to install elevators or make other changes to make those buildings accessible. It wasn't cost effective. And so in 2005, the legislature broadened the program to allow grants for construction of new libraries and renovation of existing libraries. And you have two handouts in your packets. They look like this. One is a list of all the construction grants that have been granted since 2005. And then the other is a longer 8-page document that lists all of the accessibility grants that have been granted since 1994. And there are 101 libraries that have received accessibility grants and 10 libraries that have received construction grants. So libraries across the state have benefited from this program. You can also see on these documents that although the required match is 1-to-1 state to local dollars, the actual local match has been almost $7 for every dollar of state money that's been provided for accessibility, and a little over $8 for the construction grants. So there really is a substantial local effort going on there. Despite the success of this program, we still have a lot of older library buildings in the state that have significant problems and that need either major renovation or outright replacement. The Department of Education estimates that about one-third of our library buildings are still not fully accessible. Library service has changed significantly since a lot of these older library buildings were built. Many of these older buildings don't have room for public access computers, children's programs, young adult study and research, or to accommodate new technology. And the need really is statewide. The last handout I'm going to refer to is this blue document, which lists the potential applicants for the next round of grants should we receive funding in the 2012 bonding bill. And you can see that, again, it's libraries from across the state that are very eager to apply for these grants. I do want to mention, too, process-wise, that in the past we've had a handful of individual libraries that have received funding directly in the bonding bill. If you go back 10 or 12 years, you would probably have 12 to 15 individual bills that would have been introduced and referred to this committee with requests for funding for individual libraries. We felt strongly that having individual libraries come to the legislature for funding was not the right way to do this, that it made more sense to have a competitive grant program. That was the fairest way to do this, and so this program was broadened, and we have succeeded in convincing libraries that they should go through that competitive grant program. So I think that that's a really good thing, and we hope that you will continue to fund this. Lastly, I want to emphasize that public libraries are not just a local resource. That typically, in public libraries, they serve residents from well beyond the borders of the cities and counties that provide the funding for those libraries. Your library card from your public library is good at almost any public library in the state. And it really is just your gateway to a statewide information system. And that's why we think it's appropriate for the state to participate in helping to keep our public library facilities up to date and able to serve the needs of the public. And now I'd like to turn it over to Nate Matthews, since he drove down from Staples.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Sorry, we have one more handout.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nate Matthews. I'm the city administrator of the city of Staples. I printed off about 10 handouts. I didn't have any idea how many people were here, so sorry about that. I testified to this committee in the spring of 2008 to request the opportunity to apply for funding from the State Library Accessibility Improvement Grant Program. At that time, our library is in the basement of an old Muni hospital, which was constructed in the 1930s. The main entrance to that library was the ambulance ramp, an unloading zone. The library itself was the prior emergency room of that hospital, cafeteria, and the old hospital morgue. Don't ask me how that met code in 1930, having a cafeteria and a morgue together, but it did. The library facility was moldy, dingy, dark. Our roof was leaking. The basement flooded in the springtime. And the facility was an energy pig. As you can see, some of those photos we have, that's the old hospital on the front page there. Not surprisingly, members of our community formed a group called the Staples Friends of the Library to provide grassroots assistance to myself and the city council to help research grants and options for a new facility for our community and area. In the fall of 2008, we were awarded one of these competitive grants of $420,000 from the state Minnesota Department of Education to help our city council leverage those construction dollars needed for the library. From my position as city administrator, I will say that if the state of Minnesota did not provide this grant to us, we would have not been able to build our library facility. Our tax levy could not have supported this project in our town. After the news spread in October that we received the grant, our Friends of the Library successfully raised $30,000 in 3 months in the capital campaign to help chip into the project. The rest of the funds for our project were raised by the city issuing a general obligation library improvement bond in team with the Todd County Board. The grant we received at that time provided a pivotal shot in the arm for our council. As you know, the economy tanked in the end of 2008 and 2009, but this grant helped our community believe in the importance of the project because the state did. We moved into our facility in January of 2010, and I'd like to share some before and after figures with you to demonstrate, in my opinion, how the state and local partnership is a very wise investment that has returns untold value to all the citizens. In 2008 to 2011, we had a 13% increase in circulation. We had a 36% increase in library cardholders, and we have cardholders from 12 to 14 towns and all the townships around us. There was a doubling in the Great River Regional Library's programming in the area with authors, theater programs, etc. 35% increase in items requested at the library. We had a 211% increase in computer usage alone, from 3,900 people to 12,100 users last year. The heating gas cost reduction for our facility of $15,000 a year, from $20,000 to $5,000 is what it costs. If anybody tells you that libraries are never used, they're no longer valued, they're dinosaurs, are going extinct, I urge you to tell them to come to Staples. People use them, the public values them. There is a silent majority out there that uses them very well. I come before you today again to request that you provide other communities like ours the opportunity to access this program. These dollars are very small in the scope of the state's budget, but they have tremendous impact for people in rural Minnesota. 20% of the population of Staples lives below the poverty line. 16% of the children in Staples, age 18 and under, are under the poverty line. Staples Library is a primary source for information for many people in our surrounding cities and the townships in the rural area. I personally know many people in our town for whom the library provides their own computer. They can't afford a computer, let alone $50 for internet a month. And our statistics on computer usage reflect this. As you know, Staples and small communities don't have large tax bases, and because of this, we need healthy state partnerships and relationships to ensure quality services, public facilities for everybody in Minnesota, regardless of where they live. Before I came today, a young mother dropped off a letter. She heard I was coming to talk to people at the state. And I want to read it to you. She came into my office this morning. Dear Mr. Matthews, I just found that you have had the opportunity to meet with some people responsible for a new library in Staples. I want to thank everyone involved who made this wonderful facility a reality for our community. My husband, three grade school children, and I love our library. We go almost every week to find new books, CDs, and shows. My oldest is a speed reader now, and I couldn't keep our shelf full enough to meet her appetite for books. My three children love having their own library cards and are learning about responsibility because the books checked out on their names are checked out on their names too. I've taken advantage of the interlibrary loan system many times. It's amazing how many resources I have available to me because of the local Staples branch of the Great River Library. I have found that my kids and I do better research on subjects when we utilize books more than the internet. The information seems more thorough and well-rounded. While I have the privilege of internet in my home, I have seen the library computers well used too. My family uses the library for meeting friends too. It's a safe and comfortable place for us to visit and then bring books home too. My family has attended many special events sponsored by our library. They've met a champion yo-yo thrower, a Laura Ingalls Wilder historian, and published children's book author and illustrator. Thank you for helping the Staples Library and its quality staff an integral part of my family's life. Sincerely, Alyssa Pignato.
I thought for sure I was going to say, sincerely, Mr. Pat McFarland.
In conclusion, thank you for your time. The City of Staples, our mayor, our council, the citizens, and friends of the library, thank you for the support you gave us. And we hope you continue to support public library facilities in Minnesota with this bill.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions from members of the committee? Thank you very much for your presentation. With that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 1851 as amended laid over for possible inclusion in our bonding priorities. The chair will now move House File 2001 for possible inclusion in our bonding priorities. And I do not believe you have an amendment for that, Representative McFarland.
I believe you're correct.
And Representative McFarland, we do have Representative Winkler waiting, so if we could.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you very much.
So this bill would grant Northeast Metro Intermediate School 916 money to redesign, design, construct, and furnish and equip a regional K-8 school facility to serve federal setting level 4 special education students. This money must be at least equal to the amount of the project. The money's coming from non-state resources. So I have with me Superintendent Connie Hayes.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Connie Hayes. I am Superintendent of Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District. Just a little bit of context for those of you that might not be familiar with the intermediate districts. There are three of them in the metropolitan area. Together, we serve the most aggressive, challenging students in the metropolitan area. At 916, we have 10 member school districts in the East Metro, but we serve students from a wide region beyond our member districts. About 50% of our operation at 916 is for center-based level 4 special education students. Additionally, all three of the member district, all three of the intermediate superintendents this year are making an effort to help policymakers better understand the challenges we're facing with the very complex students that are being served at the intermediate district. And I do have a document that you should have before you that has kind of a red cover to it. At some time later, you might want to read that to gain some better understanding of the needs of these students. Some of you might have been at the EMSD legislative preview presentation, and Superintendent Sandy Lewandowski gave a presentation on behalf of all the three intermediates, again, to help policymakers understand the issues that we are facing in serving this population of students. A little bit of background on how we got to this request that's coming before your committee. We are asking for support for a regional K-8 facility. Currently, 916 has 9 special education sites, 8 of them for level 4 special ed students, as I've described. We actually see around 575 to 675 students with these kinds of needs in our center-based programs each year. One of the challenges that we're facing is that our elementary age students that are being enrolled are increasing dramatically and have grown by threefold over the last 5 years. Last year, we served students from beyond our 10 member districts to include at least another 50 districts from the region and around the state. And some of those students come as far away as Moorhead, and typically those are students that are placed in a group home in one of our member school districts, and then they attend the intermediate school district. I'll talk a little bit about the map that you see up here beside me, and you also have in your handout in a moment. We started our study of our facility needs way back in 2006, and then started in 2010 to really talk to our member districts severely about the needs that we have. Even as our member districts try their best to serve all of their special education students at home in their own district, close to their families and in their homes, they recognize, and we built consensus over the idea that there'll always be a need for some opportunity for outplacement for them, some of these students that have these very complex needs. We talk a little bit in our conversation with our special ed directors that they tend to keep back at home their light level fours, and they send their heavy level fours to 916 for services. In 2011, we developed consensus with our members for a three-step plan. That three-step plan includes a consolidated K-8 facility in the Northwest region, a consolidated K-8 facility in the Southeast region, and then to maintain our central high school facilities. The map that you have in your packet and you see beside me here demonstrates to you the need that we have in our Northwest region. The boundaries around the colors that you see on the map represents all of the 10 member school district boundaries. And there's a line going through the Northwest region of the map. It doesn't show up on the map that you have, but you can see it on the card to my side here, where you can see that we simply don't have a facility to serve the students in the Northwest region, and that's why we've chosen this particular facility as our priority. We've already done some consolidation as best that we can, and when this facility is built, we will consolidate a couple of facilities that are on the map. One is Onika Elementary, where we have several classrooms, and we're growing into that facility as I speak. And then we also would consolidate the space that we have at Otter Lake Elementary. Both of those buildings are located in the White Bear Lake School District. Okay. Speed it up, she says. All right. I'm going to speak from this particular document that you have in front of you, and I won't read all of this to you, obviously, but I just want to point out the highlights. On the front page, you'll see that we're talking about the consolidation of these facilities as both a need for consolidating for the purposes of gaining cost efficiencies for our member districts and for design, because the facilities that we're in right now are not designed specifically for the kinds of students that we serve. One of the facilities we're in, just to kind of give you a concept of why a typically designed elementary facility does not work for these students, is you can think of a hallway with rooms all along the side of that hallway. Number one, those large hallways are inefficient for us because we don't pass a large number of students at any given time. The other challenge for us is that when one student from one of the classrooms goes into a crisis with their behavior, that student ends up going out into the hallway. The adults that are with that student follow that student, and then the other students in the classrooms nearby start to become dysregulated with their behavior. Other adults have to come to help that student settle down, and now we've got almost the whole facility that's going into crisis and with students that are dysregulated. So we need a unique design that will allow us, when a student does go into crisis, to quickly move to an area where the appropriate staff can help that student become greater regulated with their behavior and return back to their classroom. The second page of this handout lays out for you the requests that we have before you. We have a request of about $7 million for a total facility of about $15 million. The other portion of this facility would be paid for by local property taxpayers in the 10 member districts through the authority the legislature gives the member districts with their lease levy authority. Our member districts have asked us to come forward and request this bonding authority, and we respectfully request your permission to do so. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this project, as well as I think all the projects on the list, should be top priorities in the bonding bill. This one consolidates, does things more efficiently, less administrative costs. You know, they're working together. It's clearly a regional project. But yet, like many other good projects on this list, they didn't make the department's budget or the governor's budget because they had to pick and choose. And so I always think the education projects should come way ahead of some of the other things that actually get in the bonding bill. And so I would, but to me, all the projects speak for either a bigger bonding bill or less things in the bonding bill that we do put forward that aren't quite as urgent and speak to our future as these bills here today, certainly this one. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Looking forward, a question for Superintendent. There's proposed changes in the diagnostic criteria for autism. How do you see that impacting diagnosis rates, your services, students coming into to the intermediates? Can you project on that at all?
Thank you, Representative. We don't feel that any change in that criteria is going to impact the number of students that come into our program. The criteria will probably impact those students who would be potentially diagnosed on the other end of the continuum. We really see the very far end of the continuum.
Thank you.
Representative Flom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Noticing two things in here. It looks as if maybe a 912 facility opened up in the region because there was a distinct drop in that, and you are ramping up in the other age groups, which leads me to wonder, on your list of districts, there are three Wisconsin and one North Dakota. What sort of reciprocity, and has there been a shift in regional facilities?
Thank you, Representative. Regionally, the districts that are close by and can bus students into our facilities are really looking very hard to find a placement for these kinds of students that have these complex needs. In terms of reciprocity with the state of Wisconsin, for example, any school district that is not a member of 916 has to pay what we call it an access fee. So for the tuition and fees that a member would pay, a non-member has to pay an additional 22% above and beyond that to help cover all of the overhead costs that members pay for.
Representative Funk. Any follow-up from members of the committee? Representative McFarland, any closing comments?
No, I just hope you consider this. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 2001 laid over for possible inclusion in our bonding priorities. Thank you, Representative McFarland.
Thank you.
Representative Winkler. And members, we are going to go, due to the technology issues we had at the beginning of the committee, we are going to go past our allotted time of 2:15. So welcome to the committee. The chair moves House File 2011 for possible inclusion in our bonding priorities. And do you have an... Well, the minutes say 2011, so I'm just reading that. But all right, so the chair moves 21, what was it? 2106. How was your weekend, Representative Winkler?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it was a wonderful weekend. I hope you enjoyed Florida.
Representative Winkler, you know I was not in Florida, but at least you got the joke, which is more than I can say for some other people. So the chair will not renew his motion to have House File 2106. Representative Winkler, to your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be clear to members of the committee, the reason why there is confusion about the bill number is that I thought the Purpose Center needed to ask for more. And so the original bill was basically for some basic facility repair and asset preservation at the Purpose Center. It was in the governor's bonding recommendation. But the Purpose Center also provides training and curriculum work for school districts around the state. and they continued to have technology challenges in doing that. And so I suggested that they increase their request to include technology infrastructure improvements, and that's why we have a second bill before you today. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll just turn it over quickly to Pam Paulson from the Purpose Center to give you a quick overview of the request, knowing that less is more, as always.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Pam Paulson. I serve as the Senior Director of Policy at the Purpose Center for Arts Education, and I want to say thank you for hearing our bonding request today, and thank you for your past support of improvement and repairs that have been done to the campus. We are pleased to be included in the governor's recommendation, and as Representative Winkler said, of course, there are more needs. And as a state residential school for high school students and a professional development and research center, we have a lot of people to serve across the state. The Department of Education does a survey each year of school districts, and it indicated that 85% of the school districts in the state need services from the Purpose Center. And so we're now trying to figure out how to do that partly electronically through digital means, as well as using the campus and visiting sites across the state. Our technology is not in great shape. And Representative Winkler knows this firsthand, and we're very pleased and thankful for his leadership on this in order to meet our mission more effectively. As Representative Winkler described, there are four projects. If you look in your packet, in the very front, there is a list as well as in the bill. And they're described fairly completely, the three of them that were in the initial bill. But the technology for $1.1 million, I thought you just might need a little bit more information about that, because we do get an appropriation from you, from the legislature, each year, but we are not able to levy any additional dollars for things like technology or operating funds. We cannot levy any additional money, nor have we been eligible for any of the technology funds that have flowed from the Department of Education, because those go to school districts, and we're a state agency. So we're sort of in a pickle. We don't get funds in either direction. And we are charged to be innovative, and we are charged to be out on the cutting edge to help school districts, as Representative Winkler said, with curriculum and instruction and assessment. And we are now behind, and we need to catch up. In fact, we need to get back to leading and trying to connect with the teachers and the students across the state to improve education. We are actually looking forward to the consolidation with OET in the hopes that it will create greater efficiencies and more timely attention to technology. Carolyn Parnell, who's the new Chief Information Officer at OET, visited the Purpose Center last week and is aware of this request and understands the need for it. So just a few quick examples of what this IT would include. It would include things like upgrading and adding a cooling system to the mechanical room where we'll be housing servers. And the infrastructure, it includes building a backup system. We do not have a backup system right now for our servers. It includes attention to a phone system, which I actually can't describe in very much detail to you. But I just know that we're out in Golden Valley, and our system is not really connected or compatible very much with the state system of which we are supposed to be a part. And then, of course, having a residential program for students, we need to upgrade our security, including cameras, which have been continuing to malfunction. And there's just a whole host of this kind of infrastructure that we would really appreciate your attention to. And I forgot to tell you that Mike Zabel is next to me if you have detailed questions. He's our director of finance, and he can help answer those.
Mr. Zabel, did you have any additional comments you'd like to offer?
Mr. Chair, no, not at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Winkler, does that conclude your presentation?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for members of the committee? All right.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to point out that we didn't go over your 2:15 timeline, so I hope the committee will remember that when they consider it.
Very good. The chair will remember that you falsely claimed I was in Florida this weekend. So with that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 2106 laid over for possible inclusion in our bonding priorities. Thank you, Representative Winkler. Thank you, the testifiers. Members, that concludes our committee hearing. We'll be here tomorrow, same time, same place. This meeting is adjourned.